What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the Morning right now on WICC 600.
So today, lawmakers in the House are going to be voting on the religious exemptions regarding vaccines, which has been highly debated since even before the pandemic started. Senator Wong, what would you say are the biggest concerns people have? And what do you think is the problem with the current legislation? Is there anything sort of missing or that could be better written, do you think, with what's currently on the books?
Good morning, Melissa. And wow, that is a big question.
Do the best you can with the 5 minutes
right
we have.
To the morning. It's better than coffee.
Yeah.
It really is such an emotional issue.
Yeah, it is.
And there are both sides of the equation. And then you compound it with the concerns about COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And when people hear vaccine, they think it's associated with the COVID pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing related to it.
Right.
That's important because it relates to the nearly 70 vaccine shots that school children are required by law right now in the state of Connecticut to take before they can go to school.
Right.
In the state of Connecticut, along with other states, they allow for medical as well as religious exemptions for those individuals that feel very strongly that these shots would be against their religious beliefs or their medical well-being. So that it always allowed that, and as a result, we have this conflict right now. The current statute, there are actually two. There's one specific for the House. There is one specific for the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's very rare. They're identical languages. It seems like the majority leadership seems to want to get two shots at this bill, that if it should fail in the House today, then we have another bill in the Senate that we get another shot at it.
So they're like almost identical, just to make sure, as like a backup plan.
It is absolutely identical, which raises the question, why?
Yeah.
And for me, that is a sense of process that I've always had frustrations with this as the co-ranking member of the Public Health Committee. The process is one where people are extremely frustrated. If you remember, there was a public hearing that was limited to 24 hours via
right.
Zoom,
mm-hmm.
and nearly 1,800 people signed up to testify,
and
we only
got to
20% of the people.
Mm-hmm.
There were people, over 1,000 people left, unable to express their viewpoints, and that was another reason of the process.
Yeah.
Another is we had some significant questions of asking the Department of Education and the Commissioner of Public Health. But we were never given those answers. For example, if this passes, individuals and families that did not have those compliant required shots now would be out of school. They would be kicked out of school.
Right, unless you're seventh grade and older. They sound like they'd be grandfathered in.
Provision,
right.
Which I'll get to as well. It's interesting you say that. And obviously, it's about process, but also think about it. If there is the reason for this as a medical urgency,
mm-hmm.
right, that these kind of shots are important
right.
for greater public health, why are you grandfathering children?
Anybody in.
Right?
Well, so,
I mean, it creates kind of a mixed pool. So, again, it's another example of process.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to get to more important fundamentals, the medical sense of urgency.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been able to be validated by the public health in that. Would it be great? I want everybody to get their shots.
Right.
I believe in vaccines.
I do too.
As the co-chair of the Bioscience Caucus and a believer in the power of medicine and pharma to be able to create safer and better lives, I support that.
Yeah, of course.
But the problem is I also want to support people and parental rights. That's the difference in that sense is if I truly believe as a parent that this is not healthy or safe for my children,
the government shouldn't be telling me what to do.
I have a better choice than
yeah.
to have the government tell me what to do. It also goes down to a point of body choice. You know, we always talk about a people's right to choose, et cetera, in the various areas. Ultimately, it is a choice of personal body choice that the state is saying, we know what's better for you, and that's a real obstacle for me.
Yeah, Senator Huang, really quick, have we seen though a significant drop in certain vaccinations, which is what prompted the whole religious exemption debate, or was it the measles outbreak recently that prompted it? Like, why now? Why are we saying, hey, let's get rid of the religious exemption? Have we seen that there was this huge drop off in kids who are not vaccinated, or like what prompted this?
Well, Melissa, this has been a ongoing saga for at least 4 years.
Right.
And because there wasn't enough of a momentum, because it is truly such an emotional and divisive tug of war, that it never got through.
But I guess, like, did we make an issue out of something that was never an issue, I guess is my question?
Perhaps.
Okay.
Because it seems to be driven by such a legislative agenda. And the people... For example, the vote in the public health was strictly along party lines.
Mm-hmm.
Look, this shouldn't be a Democrat-Republican issue. It should be a belief on how people balance government input versus personal body choice. The other important part of this, incredibly, is we've not answered, what do you do with all those students and families? They're going to be kicked out of school.
Out of school, right. I was just going to say, so do we have that answer?
Right in the state of Connecticut.
Right. So what do you do? What do you do when you've got people who are not going to get their kids vaccinated? Like, what do you do?
No answers. No answers right now.
How do you pass a bill like that? I mean, are people going to leave? I would leave Connecticut.
Frustration, right? I mean, look, I believe in vaccines. I believe in the science.
Mm-hmm.
But the devil's in the detail, and I believe in process. I believe in people's rights. Now, what's the solution I encourage? Is more education, more awareness. Because there are issues of noncompliance because of concerns with, you know, there are theories in regards to how vaccines may impact autism. But the other problem is there are just a lack of education.
I agree.
And so there may be noncompliance, not because of religious exemption, but because of education and theories that have been abounded in the community. So we have to do a far better job in outreach, education, awareness, and if we're going to make a plan like that, you got to know what the consequences are.
Mm-hmm.
We're not even planning for that, and that's also challenging for me. But today's vote will be a great litmus test of whether people break away from their partisan divide and craft solutions to say, maybe we should take a pause on this and perhaps develop a comprehensive program that isn't the state telling people you got to take the shots or you're going to be kicked out of school. That is very, very draconian to me.
That's a very big bluff, too. That's a huge risk that I think people would be willing to take if you pass something like this. We're going to switch gears a little bit, Senator Huang. We're going to talk about last week, you know, five insurance carriers reached out to Governor Lamont regarding the public option, saying that this is not a good idea for Connecticut. I would have thought you'd be pretty relieved that they got involved at this point. I feel like they should have gotten involved earlier. What were your thoughts on that?
Relief is not the right word. A statement of fact is important. Private insurance companies are an economic mainstay in Connecticut, powering potentially 50,000 direct and indirect jobs related to the industry. These are Connecticut resident Connecticut jobs. And they estimate, one of the economic resource centers in Connecticut says it contributes nearly $15 billion to the state's economy. And the letter was signed by CEOs of Anthem, Cigna, United Health, Aetna, CVS, and Harvard Tufts Pilgrim Health. Now, look, insurance companies aren't always on everybody's holiday list.
No,
they
certainly not.
They have the difficult task of saying no. They have the difficult tasks of reporting accountabilities, paying bills, and sometimes they have to say no.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. And one of the biggest motivators to this issue is the escalating cost of health care insurance.
Right.
But this bill, this concept, is crafting a state-run health insurance program which bypasses the private marketplace that has had such a long-standing history and recognized by the world as the insurance capital of the world, that they can do it better. Well, unfortunately, to me, that is a very dangerous precedent because right now, the partnership program that we're modeling this public option under is running in the red. And one of the components we put in the insurance committee was an amendment that was bipartisan that said, if there is a public option plan, you have to report. You have to audit and transparency. To the controller, Kevin Lembo, who has been such a strong advocate of the public option, he called that transparency audit process, in which every insurance company in the state of Connecticut, if not in the country, has to report to the commissioner and they're reporting the data. He called it a poison pill to that bill.
Why? And like, why?
I don't know, to be honest with you, because without transparency accountability, whatever plan it is, it is going to be troubled. It's going to raise concerns. And here's the other problem. With private insurance companies, if they don't do their job well, their shareholders and their business will suffer.
Mm-hmm.
In the public option state takeover plan, if that plan fails, if that plan escalates in price, the taxpayers of Connecticut is liable.
Correct.
That's equally troubling.
Yeah.
But the CEO's making that statement says, we got 50,000 plus jobs, $15 billion of the state economy, a record, a longstanding reputation record of being the best in the country, if not in the world.
Right.
Why are we trying to recreate the new wheel and say that government can do this better than the private insurers? I'm confused too.
What's also really confusing about it, Senator Huang, is the fact that the governor has literally said on our show, multiple other news publications, he doesn't support the current bill that's being debated right now. Like, he's like, I'm not signing it. In fact, he came up with his own plan and that got shot down, as I know the Republican plan did as well. But I think it's interesting. The governor's like, I'm not signing it. So I'm curious as to why the comptroller is even continuing this effort. Like, first of all, I don't even know if he realizes that we're getting a lot of relief with the American Rescue Plan. But it just seems like if the governor's not even going to sign it, why are we going forward with it? Like, he already said no.
Melissa,
he already said no.
I believe last November after the election,
mm-hmm.
there was such an emboldenment of power and of one party rule. I think it is an arrogance of power. That it's my way or the highway.
That's obnoxious.
And even with the governor saying that he didn't like it and creating and offering an alternative plan that is very, very similar to the Republican offer plan.
Right.
That never, ever got voted on in the committee. So it is an arrogance of one party rule, a belief that their plan is far better than everybody else's, and don't even bother.
This is a waste of time, is what I'm saying. It's a waste of time that the governor says he doesn't want to sign it. It's not going to go anywhere. The governor has to sign it. So, like, what are we doing? It's just such a waste of time, I think.
Our contrast with the governor is the governor has a $50 million hit tax that would place a tax on premium.
Mm-hmm.
But listen, we need to have solutions. We need to contain health care costs.
Mm-hmm.
So reinsurance using the American Rescue money is important. Benchmarking that we said earlier, prescription drug cost containment, and audit and transparency process. Those are the four major components that would help to reduce costs. It's important for all of us to know health care insurance costs need to be contained. But it's an entire ecosystem. And I'll tell you the irony of all this, Melissa, is in one pitch of the Democratic majority and their push to say we want to lower insurance costs, we just passed out a bill that had nearly 24 other insurance mandates. Every single insurance mandate is important, Melissa, and it's critical and necessary for the people that are advocating for it. But we just passed through 24 insurance mandates. They're going to increase insurance premium costs, and we don't think twice about it. So
That's so weird. That
says we want to reduce costs continue to add to that cost.
Now, my understanding, Senator Huang, before I let you go, tomorrow there's actually going to be a vote on removing that amendment on the audit and transparency reporting, correct? Like, that's happening tomorrow?
Absolutely. And to me, again, transparency and auditing is important. What are people afraid of in discovering the facts? The other component is we're going to address the HIT tax because we're the Finance Committee and saying, what is the rationale for that taxation of insurance policy programs? Republicans had suggested using reinsurance and the federal American Rescue money
mm-hmm.
to supplement that and not put the burden of a tax on policyholders in the state of Connecticut. So it's going to be a lot of work, but the idea of looking to remove that transparency amendment is an affront to people that believe in good government.
It's just crazy to me. I understand my listeners are very aware of the fact that I have a background in health insurance because my father owns his own brokerage, as you know. And just to me, I just think, look, there are parts that when I've talked to my dad about it, he says, look, is the whole thing wrong? No, there are parts of the public option that could be great. But there are just so many confusing parts to it that don't have answers, very similar to what we were talking about with the vaccine plan with the religious exemptions, that are just not answered yet. And I just don't know, you know, why, after so many debates and everything, that we're trying to pass stuff that's broken. Essentially, it's broken.
The arrogance of power of saying one way is better than any other way.
That's infuriating.
And not listening to the critical shareholders that live and do this job every single day. Government does not provide the best solutions. But the most important part of it is process and representing the government is lost in this. And having a voice in this is absolutely critical. But if I can just maybe change the context a little bit, you have put Baby Shark in my mind for the rest of the day.
I'm so sorry. Well, now you know my pain. Now you know what I'm going through. As I talk about state issues, things that people need to know about, just know what's playing in the back of my head. It's a disaster over here.
Well,
it truly is.
As a baseball fan, you know that was the anthem for the Washington Nationals when they went on to win the World Series.
Oh, good God. I'm so sorry.
That's how I knew about Baby Shark.
No, I've known about it since the 90s. It's infuriating. I can't believe I could have been a zillionaire. I've known about this since 1995, and it just kind of died for about 20 years, and now it's back with full vengeance. And whoever came up with this, Pink Fong or whatever it is, they're zillionaires. So, you know.
Listen, I'm going to go to Hartford. I'm going to sing Baby Shark. I'm
going
to sing Mommy Shark, Daddy Shark,
do it.
Grandma Shark. It's in my head now.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
It's in my head, Melissa.
Well, I appreciate that you at least still came on, even though I've now given you a headache. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on. And again, everybody be safe and healthy and have a great week.
Thank you, Senator Wong. We appreciate it.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC 600.
And this morning we are talking to human rights attorney Spencer Hill in regards to zoning. First of all, Spencer, what are some of the most common cases you cover when it comes to zoning in Connecticut?
Good morning, Melissa. So in Connecticut, we see a lot of ways that zoning is used to kind of exclude people that a lot of municipalities don't really want in their towns. These tend to be predominantly low-income people. They tend to be predominantly people of color. So what we've been looking at and what we're seeing is how towns are kind of using their zoning regulations to make sure that people can't afford to live in their town. And they're doing it in a way that doesn't seem overtly racist, that doesn't seem overtly discriminatory, but the way the policies kind of work in practice tend to kind of exclude these groups from being able to live in their towns.
I mean, without naming a name specifically, could you give us like an example?
Yeah. So, this is actually fairly widespread. So it's not isolated to any one particular community, but what we're seeing is things like minimum floor lot sizes or minimum floor sizes for towns. So I want to build a house, I want to build an apartment building, and I need to have X amount of space. The amount of space is often beyond what is typically required for people to live comfortably in a house, and the purpose behind it is to make sure that any building has to be so large that you can't have a lot of multifamily housing. Another example would be excessive sewage and parking requirements. So, again, if you want to put in affordable housing, have smaller apartments that people can actually afford to live in, they can't do it because all of a sudden the town is saying, well, for every unit that people are going to live in, you need four parking lot spaces. So people, you know, this is... the requirements are so burdensome and so excessive that it makes building any of these affordable housing options just economically impractical. So they don't get built, so the people can't move into affordable housing in the towns. We see this kind of all across the state.
Mm-hmm. human rights attorney Spencer Hill. Question for you, because obviously zoning is one of the most debated things right now in our state capital. And, you know, I think the biggest reason people are not, if people are not for the zoning legislation, it's because it feels like the government is basically going to make the call of, listen, we're building this here. We don't really want to hear your input on it. This is what we're going to do. We know your towns and cities better than you do. That's what we're going to do. I think that seems to be the biggest controversy around this. Obviously, there are other things, but, you know, something that people have kind of been arguing is the fact that instead of, you know, just forcing sort of affordable housing in a bunch of different towns, why aren't we building up our cities better to make it more affordable? For example, you've got Bridgeport, Connecticut. I remember my husband and I looking at Bridgeport, and, you know, we certainly are not by any means well off at all. We are kind of like average, like I'd say middle-class homeowners. We couldn't afford to live in Bridgeport. You know, Bridgeport's got some of the highest taxes in Connecticut, let alone just to buy property there. So, you know, do you think there is an issue, though, that we're not focusing enough to build up our cities where typically you're finding people who need affordable housing?
Absolutely. This is not an issue of one or the other. Mm-hmm. It's very much something that we need to do both. Right now, affordable housing that there is in the state tends to be concentrated in our cities. So, for example, 76% of black people in our state and 68% of Hispanic non-white people live in cities that tends to concentrate the poverty. Mm. We need to reinvest in these cities. We need to make sure that people who want to live there have access to the resources, both infrastructure, educational, employment opportunities. Reinvestment in our cities is absolutely crucial, and it needs to be done in a way that really listens to the people living in those towns and hearing from them what do they need, rather than someone coming in and telling people what they need. So reinvesting in our cities is absolutely crucial. The issue is that any of that reinvestment is going to take a while to have an effect. There's going to be a lag between when the kind of initial investments are made and when they start kind of paying off. So while that's happening, we need to make sure that people have the choice to move into different towns or suburbs or rural areas if they want to. It's not about one or the other. It's about expanding options for everyone.
And, you know, Attorney Spencer Hill, what do you think about expanding options for employment? And look, I'm not trying to be naive. I really try to ask questions that I don't fully know the answer to, not, you know, for my listeners' benefit, but also for my own. You know, like when you talk about that people are discriminated against in towns, per se, I find it hard to believe, and maybe I'm wrong. Like, are there really towns in Connecticut saying, I don't want to see a black person living here, I don't want to see a Hispanic person living here? Or is it truly that people are not getting the opportunity to be able to afford living in these towns? That's an honest question. Like, I'm just not sure what you're seeing from your professional standpoint. Like, are we really seeing towns that are excluding people based on the color of their skin, or is it a matter of an economic, like, issue? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yeah. Well, so it's kind of both, in as much as so economics is tied to race in America. Mm-hmm. In kind of statistically speaking, we due to a long history of racial discrimination in employment and housing, there is a wealth gap in America, and we need to kind of recognize that any policies that exclude people based on their socioeconomic status is going to have a racial impact.
Totally.
Just statistically speaking. Mm-hmm. In terms of the actual towns, what we're hearing is a lot of we want to protect the character of our towns. We want to make sure we don't have anything against specific families or specific people or even kind of in principle, we have nothing. But we just want the right people. We want them to fit in. We want them to feel uncomfortable. But the reality is that inclusion drives diversity, not the other way around. Mm. People tend to think if we just bring people of color into these towns, if we increase the diversity, that'll kind of combat all the racism. that may be true to some extent, but it's really the opposite way around. If you make these towns inclusive and welcoming, if you make them places where everyone feels accepted, both economically and socially, that is going to increase the diversity of the towns. That's going to make this truly a place where everyone can kind of feel welcome and feel at home in Connecticut.
I'm just wondering, Spencer, though, if we need to focus more on, I don't disagree with you at all. I think it would be ridiculous to even say that it would change the character of a town. Like, to me, that's just ridiculous. I totally agree with you. I'm just wondering, though, like, instead of taking away the zoning rights that are kind of in place for towns and cities right now, should we be focusing more on fixing gender and racial wage gaps? Like, that's a huge issue. Wage gaps, I can't even believe it's still an issue in 2021, but it is. It's ridiculous. Like, the fact that we had to pass a law that says, hey, you can't discriminate against somebody because of their hairstyle in Connecticut. I can't even believe we have to have a law that says that. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think there are archaic things that should be eliminated before we look at something else. I don't know. Maybe I'm just talking crazy.
Yeah,
but,
no.
You know?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. There are a lot of these kind of symptoms of discrimination that are wild, that they're still happening.
It's insane.
But affordable housing really is at the kind of root of them. Because think about it like this. So you talked about needing to make sure economics and jobs are more equal. Well, how do people get their jobs? Most often, it's going to a place close to where they live, where they can afford to live. They choose to kind of work in places that have good schools, where their children can feel acceptable. When they're choosing a place to work, they need to worry about transportation. How am I going to get to work? All of these things are kind of rooted on where you live.
Mm.
Where you live kind of is the baseline for everything else.
That's a good point.
So kind of addressing all of these other issues are really symptoms, and they're important and they need to be addressed, but they're symptoms of housing segregation. There are symptoms of wealth gaps, which are also tied to housing segregation. Mm-hmm. After all, if the prime way that wealth is conveyed from generation to generation is through owning a house and passing it on to your children.
Right.
So
right.
If you don't address kind of the housing issues, all of these other things are still going to persist. But tackling the housing issues, which tackles employment and education, that's really going to be where we can make some real meaningful change.
Human rights attorney Spencer Hill, thank you so much for coming on this morning and explaining that. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
From Shelton to Southport, from Newtown to New Canaan, if it affects Fairfield County, it's on Melissa in the Morning. WYCC 600.
All right, 203-333-9422. Our number again is 203-333-9422. We are talking about the question of the day. I'm getting a lot of responses from you guys on Facebook and Twitter. On Twitter, 100% of our voters said no, they don't want to see summer vacation go away for our Connecticut schools. But on Facebook, a lot of you are torn whether or not we should see summer vacation go or stay. This comes as Governor Lamont sat down at the end of the week last week, did a roundtable discussion with federal, state, and local leaders, including those in the education sector, deciding, look, we're getting a lot of money in the state of Connecticut. We're going to be given a lot of money, and they think this is the time. It's now or never. Do we change the school calendar, school scheduling, which would include possibly getting rid of school summer vacation? I kind of shared with you when I was on school break in the summertime as a kid, honestly, I was bored after about a month. I would not hate the idea of staying in school for a full 12 months, having more breaks, having maybe longer breaks, but taking a quarter of the year off to just have the summer, I don't know if it's the best approach for education. I do know in September it's all basically review, and that could be used for learning more. So I'm not opposed to the idea, but this is where I would love to get your feedback on it. Let's start with Barbara, who's calling in this morning from Milford. Barbara, what do you think about this?
I think it's archaic that we have school off for 3 months a year.
Mm-hmm.
This all started when we were an agricultural country and they used to use the children to help in the fields. This is a detriment to our children because they actually go brain dead in the summer. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you were bored. I was very, very bored, but I was a reader. And I know with my own children and my grandchildren, They have to start all over again in September.
Mm-hmm.
So if the teacher takes like a whole 3-4 weeks to get them acclimated back into the classroom. So I personally think that they should go all year round and have those long vacations. Think about having 3 weeks with your children at Christmas
mm-hmm.
and Easter and the different things. You're still going to have the same amount of time off when they allocate the time, but it just won't be a big block where some children that are not, they're just not stimulated by themselves, that they can turn around. I think our whole United States, our testing and everything would go up if we did that.
Barbara, thank you for the call. I think, you know, something else that Barbara mentioned that I think is so true, you know, I can agree with the archaicness. You know, if we had something in place, she mentioned, you know, the original reason for the 3 months off was so that kids could help with the farms. If we had something that was like, it required job training, for example, like if you required that for those 3 months, your child had to be set up to do some kind of job training or do something where they are doing community service, you know, something like that. I could totally see, like, once you get into middle school and high school in, you know, instead of going to school in the summertime, maybe doing some kind of, you know, job training. Because, look, I do also think in the education system, here's what we lack. You know, we could go as high as to saying we do all these different sciences and mathematics, and there's always the question, why is this going to matter when we're adults? And a lot of times we're like, oh, because of this and that. But really, at the end of the day, do kids know how to file taxes? Do kids know how to budget? No, they don't. We don't talk about those kinds of things. Like, just literally growing up and knowing adult skills or job training skills, we also don't have incorporated in our schools. We just don't. Now, there are some nonprofit organizations who are very dedicated to this. We do know there are some programs that have been set up to also be dedicated to this. But overall, we lack that in our education system. There are so many kids who get handed a credit card when they're 18 and they go to college and they can't understand why they have a horrible credit score by the time they graduate. Because we don't teach them how to pay off bills. We don't teach them about interest. We don't teach them about these things in school. It's not part of the curriculum. So that would be another thing. If we didn't want to have kids stay in school for the full 12 months and we want to give something like a summer break, well, then let's change the archaicness of, oh, hey, if you don't want to go to summer camp, or hey, you don't want to read on the reading list, or hey, you don't want to go and do summer school. Well, then let's give some kind of an option so that kids don't become, like Barbara said, brain dead because they're taking 3 months off from school. 203-333-9422. That is our number here. We also are on Facebook and Twitter, WICC600. Calling in right now is Steve from Bridgeport. Steve, what are your thoughts on changing the school schedules?
Well, if you looked at it already, they're really not off as long as back in the day when I was a kid. I'm 63 years old. And if you grew up back in the 50s, 60s, and the 70s, having the summer off was just a magnificent time. Some of the brightest people today in economics, in finance, in movies, theater, all creative areas, are all people that came from having the summer off. So in regards to that, like I said, now the kids don't have off as long as we did. So I think it's a marvelous time. I enjoyed it. And I think some of the brightest people today came from that format. It didn't seem to hurt them.
Okay. All right, Steve. No, I appreciate it. So when you were a kid, how much time did you get off for the summertime?
Well, back in the day, used to go back to school. I went to Catholic school. Used to go back to school around September 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And then we used to get out around June 15th or June 20th, somewhere in that time frame. And Again, it was a different time. There was a lot more of the moms home. I understand that. But we played in the street. Where I grew up on Long Island was on 40 by 100. We had a village pool. We had Christopher Morley Park. We were free. We went out that door in the summertime, and we played in the street, and we played outside in Little League. And we were just free to do whatever we want. Those of us who grew up in that, and the same thing, I'm sure in places like Bridgeport and there's parts of Stratford, and I'm sure Milford, who had a similar kind of layout that I came from.
Mm-hmm.
You went to the candy store. You were free. And again, I know it was a different time. Our moms were home. So, you know, but all I'm trying to say is that people today, a lot of inventions, people who work with the cellular phones, a lot of the people today, some of the inventions and technologies we had are people who had off all summer, and mm-hmm. it didn't seem to affect some of the advancements we have in technology today. You know, and like I said, now kids go, they get out of school like June 20-something, and they go back sometime in August. So they're really not home. They're really home all of the month of July and, let's say, August. So it's really an eight-week schedule. It's not, you know, we had almost like 10
Three
or 11
months.
Weeks off
yeah.
back in the day.
No, good point, Steve. I mean, I definitely think, unfortunately, we live in a time where, you're right, I think we see more dual-income households. And so kids are sitting in front of TVs. They're sitting in front of computer screens more. Like, I mean, when we were kids, it was the same way. When we were really little, I mean, we were always out on a scooter, rollerblading with the neighborhood kids. But I got to be honest, like, now with my three-year-old, I don't know one of my neighbors. It's just, it's very, we were just talking about this yesterday, my husband and I. Thank you for the call, Steve. We were just talking yesterday, actually, about the fact that my husband and I, we are almost envious of our good friends who have this really beautiful neighborhood in West Haven, and they know their neighbors by name. And, you know, we've talked to our neighbors. It's not that they're not very nice. It's just a matter of, it's just odd. It's like this weird socialism that we just don't socially connect with our neighbors like we used to back in the day. And I think, unfortunately, we don't have the same trends that summer vacation used to be. But good point, Steve. Definitely a good point. And I can't disagree with what you're saying. That's awesome.